Thanks to Acast for hosting and monetizing the podcast.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Oh, hi, hello there. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am your host, Liv, the one who likes to curse and make bigots angry. And here I am again today with a magnificent and so very fun conversation episode, or in this case, the second ever two-part conversation episode. I spoke with Eduardo Garcia Molina, perhaps best known for providing otter photos and memes on Classics Twitter, and also the less adorable but even more interesting Hellenistic period, and the Seleucids specifically within that period. Eduardo studies and is deeply knowledgeable about the wonders of the Hellenistic period that's so often forgotten when we talk about the ancient world because, as he calls it, it suffers from middle child syndrome, that time between the height of classical Greece, the rise of Alexander the Great, and the later Roman Empire. And we talked about it forever. It was so much fun and so interesting. These episodes are the perfect examples of how much I love to just sit back and let scholars talk, share whatever fascinating things come to their minds about their specialties. This episode is also somewhat unique because it's deeply about the history, the historical period broadly, kind of everything that was taking place during the Hellenistic period, a period that I notoriously am bad at utilizing because I know so little about it. And like my mythological obsessions tend to lie in the archaic and classical period. So while I'll read you all things and sources from the Hellenistic, I don't know much about it. But turns out the Hellenistic period is so, so fascinating because everything changed in the ancient world and everything expanded and grew. There was so much interaction between the Greeks and the wider Mediterranean world and beyond. Granted, just because this was a particularly imperial time, but still, there's so much to say about the Hellenistic period in the East, so much beyond Greece and Rome. Now, why am I even vaguely trying to explain the intricacies of the Hellenistic period when I could just direct you straight into this episode because it's wonderful? But also, Eduardo joined me to talk about video games that feature the ancient world, so that's kind of how we begin things. Video games beyond AC Odyssey, because there are others, even if all I talk about is Odyssey. We talk Rome, Total War, and beyond. We talk otters, briefly, and memorably. Eduardo provides the podcast's first ever Spanish content. Conversations, the Hellenistic period and its middle child syndrome with Eduardo Garcia Molina.
Spanish is my first language. You will hear me say Spanish.
Oh, I've noticed a lot of it. It's great. I love it. I do that with, like, I'm not French, but I grew up in, or I'm like not grew up, but like I grew up in a French family and I'm from Quebec, but like I barely speak French, but I use a lot of like weird French words in my sentences as if they're English. And so I love that. You definitely use a lot more than I do, but I
well, yeah, I was born in Puerto Rico, and we moved when I was 10 years old.
Okay, yeah.
And the Caribbean especially, they really like, because of course we're under the umbrella of the American Empire since 1898, well before that, but especially Cuba and Puerto Rico after 1898. Yeah. But there's a lot of like Spanglish. You're going to call it Spanglish, but it's like you just naturally incorporate it into your, and there's so much slang. That's one of the things that I actually study, that I've gotten more and more into, especially, again, now that I'm out of coursework, now that I can breathe a little bit. One of my interests, aside from, you know, the Seleucids, which is my main thing, but I've been writing and researching more and more on the reception of classics in, like, the Caribbean, especially. Yeah, I submitted an abstract. No que madera, si Dios quiere, it's going to be accepted for SCS in New Orleans, looking at Cuban adaptations of Greek tragedies using Cuban slang and musical cues and costuming and humor to kind of, como que se dice, to subvert like the traditional, oh, classics is for the elite, like, because especially in like the colonial settings of Cuba and Puerto Rico, that was a way that Spanish elites could differentiate themselves, is through a classical education. And you see this in America still. So nothing, not much has changed. In Britain, you still, pero, yeah, especially in like the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, you start seeing these adaptations that like poke fun, that play around with Greek myths and interject just like, there's actually a Cuban adaptation of the Odyssey called La Odilea that uses like super slangy Cuban, like, don't get me wrong, my family is mostly from Cuba and then we moved to Puerto Rico. So like, if I speak Spanish, you will hear that coming out of me, pero like some of those slangs are like super specific regions in Cuba, but it's super targeted for a general audience coming out of the increased social pressures of the 50s and 60s in Cuba, especially like with the revolution and everything, making classics and making these things available to all. And you have these, it's super like down to earth, low slang. But yeah, the stuff like that I've been able to research more now that I'm in my fourth year and really get to write on that. I have a secret abstract that I'm currently writing for this conference on like classical reception in porn.
That's a thing. I mean, of course, it's a thing now that I hear it. Like, of course it is, but wow.
So because then I can talk about like El Coloquio de los Centauros, which is Darío, a famous poet he writes this Colloquium of the Centaurs that is just this wonderfully beautiful poem that has just centaurs talking amongst themselves in Spanish. That has so many ancient references. It's absolutely like, it's so thick with ancient references. It's like if you're reading Pindar. It's just like chock full of things like lineages and everything, things that you cannot pick up if you don't know your like centaur family tree, which I don't know that much right now. It's either that or satyrs in gay daddy culture, or satyrs as daddies in gay culture. Because in antiquity you have satyrs in the Cyllene that have, like, you know, the paunch bellies. They're older men. They're fairly gross. Like, the Cyllene especially are, like, they look kind of like Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
Slightly taller. No offense to Danny DeVito.
I mean,
he's actually a national treasure. He's
I say one of the best people out there.
But he knows.
Absolutely. It's like,
see. But, yeah, like, you see porn now that's just, like, leaning into like the dad bod, like the older thing, and they're actually seen as a thing that you can be sexually attracted to. So I don't know which one.
That's so interesting.
I the centaur one, the title, gonna be an annoying like snippy title, long thing. Pero like,
okay, can you reference the version of Chiron where he has the full body of a man in the front with the horse on the back? Because every time I mention that, then it's a big question of like, does he have two dicks? Does he have one of each? And it's only Chiron. It's only sometimes.
Because you have those archaic statues, right, of centaurs also. There's that one. I forget in what museum it's at.
Because I'm picturing there's pottery of one where it's like literally just Chiron is like a full guy wearing the full outfit, and then he's got a horse butt coming off of him. And
there's a statue of it. I think it's like 7th century or 6th century, like a bronze statuette. See, I'll link it to you afterward. He for sure is just like full man, human genitalia. And then I actually don't know if he also has. I don't know if they have a 3D in the museum and you can just go under and go like, oh, there you are.
That's the thing. In the pottery, you can't tell because he's like also wearing everything.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's just a matter of like the imagination. But I love the idea that there's a statue too.
And that's like one of the questions. Like, because centaurs are like that. It's this dynamic of the rationality of the man that's on top. And then you have like the bestial, lustful component of the horse, which is underscored by the horse have giant genitalia. it ties into like Apuleius, you have the golden ass, you have that scene with the donkey. So the ancients thought of this too. You have like, there's this Roman terracotta lamp that has, but I'm pretty sure it's just a farmer having relations with like a sheep or something. But in agrarian societies, these topics, I'm not saying they're like, I'm not giving assent to them, but I'm just saying in an agrarian society where people are more like encountering animals all the time, these things just like happen, and you see them more and more frequently in like text and objects than we do today. For a variety of factors. One of them is, of course, the increase in urbanization where like people don't, and also just like, it's bad.
Yeah.
Feel the need to say that. Yeah. Did you see that Aristotle quote with the otter thing? Oh. I almost had a heart attack when I first saw it. So let me see if I can get it right now. So Aristotle, there's a quote in his Historia Animalium that talks about the otters, and I translated it. The otter also bites humans and does not surrender, so they say, until it hears the crack of bone.
Otters are terrifying and also adorable.
Yeah, it's why I like them. It's why I think they're the epitome of classics Twitter. It's like, people can take a break for them, or like I can just be like this wicked witch of the West that just like summons otters to attack, like the Furies or something, to attack people.
That's great.
Yeah, no, it's just like, and also like, we all need some brevity. Like, there's too many people that take that seriously. Like,
yeah,
I write, I publish, like, I am an active scholar, but I don't feel the need to, like, you know, put on airs every 4 seconds or people know what I do.
And that's not what Twitter's for. And if you're using it that way,
it's social media.
Yeah. Twitter's fun.
Sí, yeah. Exactamente. It doesn't have to be like, people should just take more hints from like the Cubans. You can make fun of things. Like, you can still hold reverence and like make fun of things.
That's basically my podcast in a phrase.
Absolutely.
Like, people sometimes get mad at me and are like, how do you love them if you're, you know, insulting the gods so much? And I'm like, we can do both. They do ridiculous things. I'm not going to
They're legitimately terrible.
They are. They're awful. And like, I started my podcast because people who talk about Greek mythology, especially like in pop culture, tend to just make them these like incredible, like warm and fuzzy people, like Disney's Hercules style, which is absurd and not based in mythology. And the cool thing about them is that even the ancient Greeks saw them as like complex and problematic and dangerous and weird. And so I'm going to
exactly. No, and they also had a sense of humor about them. Like, it's not like we're, you can love something, you can love studying something, and you can maintain a sense of, it's imperative that you maintain a sense of humor about it. Because at the end of the day, it is like, they themselves thought that some of this stuff was ridiculous.
Like, the Homeric hymn to Hermes is the number one biggest proof of like, they also thought it was funny.
Baby Hermes.
Baby Hermes doing everything, stealing cows and faking footsteps. And
you can have a mixture of reverence to something and still find humor in it. Like, they are, like, my family, Catholic, the kingdom come. But, like, still, you have to have humor about it. And, like, so my abuela still lights candles and everything. And sometimes she just goes, she just shrugs and goes, maybe it'll work. Like, it's complex. And you can do humor while still loving it. Yeah, like, for example, you were talking about Disneyfication of some of these myths. You also have the thirstification of you've seen that new Hades game. Well, not new anymore. It's like a year and a half, 2 years old now.
I've only seen people talking about it in screenshots and stuff, but yeah.
Have you seen the character designs for them? They are begging. It is like thirst traps. Every character is a thirst trap. They knew they were doing that. Good on them. Hey, they're supposed to be like greater than human things, but they knew exactly. And it worked out well for them. The game's great, and the developers have had a wonderful success with it. So but it's for sure like Rule 34 trap. Like, they know what the internet's going to do to it.
You got to find the way. I mean, this ancient world, we can do kind of, you know, what we need to work with it, I guess. I don't know. That's not particularly eloquent.
Yeah. And it happens too with video games to a certain degree, because you have, for example, like Rome, Total War 2. So those are the type of games that I focus on when I do like Archeo gaming stuff. Well, that and Pokemon, apparently. But like, I focus more on your bog standard strategy games, because my main research is about like ancient states and the, like, Assassin's Creed has Sparta versus Athens and everything like that, but it doesn't have, like, how people conceptualize ancient states actually working. Mm-hmm. Like, what do they think the realities of ancient states is like? Like, how do they function and everything? And, like, for example, in Rome, Total War II, when you beat an army, an enemy army, you have three choices. One of them is you take on captives, and you replenish your troops by doing that, if you lost any troops in the battle. I might be getting my Total Wars mixed up, but yeah, one of them is like, you can release them. You can take captives, you can release them, kill them, or put them into slavery with one button. No, I'm not saying that is inherently, because I'm not a developer. I understand that game mechanics have to come first, and like the player experience has to come first. But we also have to think about how like something as complex as just enslaving people and generally negative as enslaving people gets gamified into clicking a button. Mm-hmm. And then the player is it's usually bonuses because you get slaves and then your economy goes up. You get like public order. I understand that it's working within the game mechanics. I'm not saying like, oh, we should just like cancel Rome, total war. It's useful to think about, to use these examples to think about how people think of antiquity and how it's received, how superficially people think about ancient slavery or something like that, or people that gamify it, not only in terms of like video games, but like economics, like, oh, you have this number of slaves, like just using people as numbers or viewing people as numbers, efficiency or how to maximize work and not thinking about the human suffering that contributes to it.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
So yeah, I'm writing a blog post for People in the Past about that, how ancient state, not about slavery in game mechanics, I would love to do one about that, but about like how ancient states are viewed, like what traits, if you play Civ, like Rome gets a bath specific building, and that means, that usually means they get more population growth. They get legionaries as special troops, and they get bonuses to like fighting better. So that naturally gives a militaristic, an expansionist portrayal of Rome that influences the player's narrative. And so that's how they think of, like, it's just another popular reception. Mm-hmm. Except this one's so much more complicated and intriguing, I think, personally, for me, because you have player choice. And you have game mechanics being presented, factions being given, like, specific units to kind of distill them into their essence, at least what the developers think their essence is, but it's still in like the game mechanic, so they still have to function within it. So that's why I'm like always interested, like, how are the Greeks portrayed? Oh, they get a special unit, the hoplite, no surprises there, but like they get bonuses to science because they have the academy building, so they research faster, and you're going, okay, so they're like nerds and they can fight somewhat well if they have a, so yeah, stuff like that is mm-hmm. super interesting to think about how it affects
and like plays on like the sort of general understanding of those two cultures too, right? Like the sort of yeah. inherent, the Greeks are smart and creative and the Romans are war, all about yeah. war.
It's, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and it drives these narratives. And it's influenced by, like, research. For example, like, in Rome Total War II, Rome gets, like, manpower bonuses. So they, if they lose soldiers, they can get them back quicker. Basically, they can recuperate their losses quicker. And that has to do a lot with, like, research into the population of Italy and how that contributed to Roman expansion. P.A. Brunt's work on Italian manpower in the 70s, the work of Walter Scheidel. But you can see it superficially, of course, because again, like, it's a game. The developers are constrained by the fact that they have to make something that people can actually play. You can put a bunch of numbers, you can simulate a bunch of stuff, but at the end of the day, like, player experience comes first, so history has to be sacrificed to that. Yeah, you can totally see that. In, like, I study the Hellenistic empires in these games, and you went to Greece. I don't know if you particularly saw, when I went to Greece for the first time, I went to the American Summer School, or excuse me, the ASCSA Summer School in Athens 2 years ago. And we did a trip around a bunch of Greece and we visited a bunch of museums. And I naturally gravitated towards the material and Hellenistic stuff. And you still see this, like, oh, the Hellenistic period is when Greek culture advances into the East. And you still have this, like, dominant narrative of Greeks going everywhere and just stamping their identity onto these places. Mm-hmm. When it's such a more complicated period, it's such a rich period for cultural dynamic, cultural interaction, just like, and people don't like in the video game, in strategy games, Hellenistic empires typically have, like, bonuses to spread Hellenistic culture. They can only build Greek temples dedicated to the Greek pantheon. But you have instances of Seleucid kings, of Ptolemaic kings and queens, of course, being patrons of native temples, of indigenous temples, like, because that's just the way it doesn't work. Like, the Greeks don't paint the map, like, in whatever color you want to ascribe to whatever Hellenic is as a culture. It's such, and I think that's what initially drew me to that period. So yeah, I guess maybe to, like, the Hellenistic period, it suffers from middle child syndrome, as we talked about briefly in the beginning.
I am so guilty of that, which is why I'm so excited to have you on and talk about this, because I'm like, I'm so all about archaic and classical. And for me, it's because of the mythology, right? Because most of the, like, mythology itself was developed back then. Of course, we have some incredible works from the Hellenistic period, but they're usually working off of older sources or older ideas. So I just tend towards those too. But of course, yeah, I mean, the Hellenistic period was super important and interesting. Yeah. And so, yes. First, can you give me a quick, for my listeners, and also to remind me, because my degree was so long ago now, who are the Seleucids?
Okay, so the Hellenistic period begins, and this is the thing, periodization is horrible. Periodization, but we need it, because, like, human beings can only think of time in, like, chunks. Like, time is such a crazy concept that we have to divide it. And, like, for scholarship also, you have to be a scholar of a period or something like that. It's just the way things work. So we have to very artificially do, this is the classical period, this is the Hellenistic period, this is the imperial period, when in actuality, it's all the same. Like, time and people. Alexander died in 323, and that's the start of the Hellenistic period, traditionally the start of the Hellenistic period. But it's not like the world just went, aha, we are now in the hell. It's not like a game of, like,
Civ 6. Age of Mythology is my reference point, where you, like, upgrade and suddenly there you are. You're in the new age. You're in the Hellenistic period.
All the buildings look a little bit more spruced up. Like, but again, yeah. So the Hellenistic period is traditionally dated from 323, the death of Alexander, to 31 BCE, the Battle of Actium, and then Augustus's consolidation of Rome and the Eastern Mediterranean.
So Hellenistic includes some time under Rome then.
See, so
interesting. I didn't know
that. And that's one of the things I focus on, because I focus on the Seleucids. And the Seleucids are one of the quote unquote successor kingdoms that occurred. So Alexander died in 323. The next 20 years is what I like to refer to my students as the Macedonian telenovela. Because, oh my God, those 20 years after Alexander dies, it is some of the most confusing, plot twisty, Game of Thrones, Red Wedding series, chain of events. There are so many contenders that are popping up everywhere. People die all the time. But then eventually in 301, after a major battle, you start seeing the empires kind of settle down. The borders somewhat remain fairly fixed. And you have basically the big three. There's the big three, quote. Some Adelaide fanboys are going to hate me for this by not including them in the big three. But you have the Antigonids. They're in Macedonia. They eventually gain a foothold there. You have the Seleucids, and then you have the Ptolemies. And those are kind of the big three. And then you have smaller kingdoms that are of equal import, like Pyrrhus and Epirus, or the Attalids in Pergamon. But yeah, the Hellenistic period is defined by the fragmentation of Alexander III's conquests, because he might have been a good conqueror, he was not a good administrator. And you need that, you know, to kind of maintain what you have.
It's pretty good proof what happened, that was sort of his way. Like, he died very young, he conquered a lot of land, died very young, and none of it really remained what he had.
Exactamente. So then you have the Hellenistic period, is these larger kingdoms jostling for power, smaller kingdoms around the periphery. They're still there. They still play a major part in politics. There's so much interaction between so many polities, not only in places like Asia Minor. Asia Minor is a hotbed. So much stuff happens in Asia Minor, but also in the Near and Far East. You have places like Ikanum, that's in Afghanistan, one of the farthest reaches of the Seleucids. And you have interactions with the Mauryan Empire in India. You have actual inscriptions that name Antiochus I and Ptolemy in India. It's crazy stuff. And in interactions with Central Asia, there's just so much there. But it does get buried under this, just your stepping stone on the way to Roman consolidation of the Mediterranean. And that's when stuff gets good, apparently. not for a variety of peoples. It suffers from that. It also suffers from big men syndrome. You know, history is the history of big men, quote unquote. Because you have, of course, Alexander III, gigantic figure at the beginning. And you have Cleopatra VII at the very end. There's not a lot of it. When people think of the Hellenistic period, they think of these two, and that's it. And that's why you have like a continuing thing about like who's going to be cast as Cleopatra. Like, there's so many other Cleopatras that are great. I think we can leave Cleopatra the Seventh alone for now. Do Cleopatra Thea, who was in like a Seleucid queen, or a Ptolemaic queen, but then she married into the Seleucids dynasty from the 150s and on, who survives like three husbands. She kills one of them, to be fair. And
best way to survive one, I suppose. Yeah.
And one of my favorite things is there's a quote in Appian, I believe, and he describes her as having an insane hatred for all of humankind. So I think if she was alive today, she would do like super great on Twitter. Yeah. I think she would be like an amazing poster on Twitter.
I mean, I really identify with that.
Yeah.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
It has a lot to do with modern scholarship, but also in like the Greeks and Romans themselves saw this period as kind of transitory. When you see Greek and Roman authors talk about Hellenistic kings and queens, it is usually with an insane amount of shade. They do not like them. They are rich. They are luxurious. They are Eastern, which is the gasp in the conservative.
Barbarians.
Yeah, because they fall into this, because their empires fell, as all empires do after a while. So they're not, you know, they're not special. But it's tied to these Greek and Roman perceptions of the East as a place of luxury, of corrupting luxury. Dionysus went there and he came back and he brought us some good stuff. But imagine if he brought us some good stuff. That place has to be filled with temptations and everything. He brought us winemaking. Like, great, that's great. But like, the East has always been in the Greco-Roman imaginary, this place of like corrupting wealth and also sexuality. Like, mm-hmm. Oh my God. The Hellenistic kings are lusty. The queens are lusty. So the Hellenistic period suffers from not only middle child syndrome in terms of modern audience, they just want to get to like, the crazy Roman emperors and aren't they crazy when, you know, Hellenistic kings and queens have been talked smack about since antiquity. You know, where do you think they get all those stories? Kingship, Hellenistic kingship and queenship, like the negatives, you see so many echoes of that in complaints about Julius Caesar wanting to become king, right? You see in all translation, it bothers me so much that in all translations of, you know, that famous scene in the Lupercalia when Antony presents the wreath to Caesar three times and he's like, oh, you want to be king? And he says, no. And the crowd applauds because the Romans don't like kings. And then Antony goes up and presents the crown again. And he goes, no. And the crowd claps even louder. And Antony for a third time tries to give him the wreath. And Caesar refuses it for a third time. And then the crowd goes, yeah, he's refusing kingship. It's a diadem. And a diadem is this, most translations say wreath. And the diadem is this headband that's worn around the head of Hellenistic kings. Mm. It's purple, the color of kings, the color of royalty, the color of money. And you see this on coins and everything. And after that, statues of Julius Caesar around Rome are diadems are placed on them by people that don't like Caesar. They want to accuse him of trying to become a king. So like echoes of the Hellenistic period are everywhere. It shapes every single thing, but it gets so quickly buried under the predominance of the classical period in how you said like the formative elements of things like myth, of the heyday of the Spartans and the Athenians. But yeah, you have like Pericles. You have these things that people fixate on. No one talks about Athens in the 4th century like, for long. So it's sandwiched in here. It's seen as a speed bump, but it influences so much of what happens later with Rome. And it influences, like, in terms of myth, you have an insane amount of new travel. You have people traveling all over because now you have these big empires. They want troops. They want settlers. They want people to fill the new cities that they're creating. So they bring in people from all over, especially from Greece, but from all over. People place great emphasis on these foundations and like a Seleucid foundation in Seleucia Tigris. And most of the people living there were actually just natives, like indigenous people of the area that were brought into the city. But still, in like general treatments of the period, in the books that people read, in like the history, like general history books, this period is just seen as, oh, Hellenistic culture comes in to areas where it had not reached afterwards. Mm-hmm. And that's not how culture worked. Like people are not just passive recipients of culture. If you see a statue with imagery that's familiar to you, you rationalize it in your head based on your value sets of your lived experiences. You bring that into your interpretation of something, which is why, for example, I study coins. Coins are great. For example, in Cilicia, in the 120s, Tarsus gets to a city called Tarsus, gets to mint its own coins. The Seleucid kings let them mint coins. It's called municipal coinage. And the figure that they opt to put on their coins is Sandan, which is a Hittite god that's still worshipped in that area.
Yeah.
Even after, right? Like in the 120s BCE, you see this Hittite god still there. And it influenced, and that influence keeps on going into the Roman period, where you see him subsumed with Zeus and Heracles especially. So people just like aren't just there. Greek culture isn't a thing to be imparted on people. It is present there. We can't just go, oh, these empires are like benevolent. No, but any empire is not like really any statal administration is not benevolent. They just want to extract resources from you. But still, it's a period of so much cross-cultural interaction, give and take. And you see this not only in coins, but in inscriptions too. One of my favorites that I bring up in classes is you have the city of Sidon in Phoenicia. I believe this inscription is dated to the 3rd century, late 3rd century, I believe. It's this guy, Diotimos. He gets honored by the city, a Phoenician city, for being the victor of the chariot races in the Nemean Games. And in that inscription, Sidon's going, ah, now the Greeks know the name Sidon. Because you have this increase in pan-Hellenic games during the Hellenistic period. Everybody wants to, well, local elites especially, want to be part of this greater conversation of like, what is it to be Hellenic? What is it to be Greek? So you have the city honoring this guy who won a chariot race. And in the end, the city of Sidon makes a little reference to Cadmos, the founder of Thebes, because he is said to be from Sidon. So you have a Phoenician city like grabbing these traditions, these Greek mythical traditions, and like weaving it into their civic identity.
Okay, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I keep going, but also I have questions.
No, go for it. Shoot, because I have a tendency to ramble on. No. I can talk about this. It shows that.
It's one of my favorite things, though, is just getting people like you talking about the thing that you know so well. It's the best. But you said Cadmus, which means now I have questions. So I was going to ask this regardless. And then you started talking about Phoenicia and Cadmus. So I really had to. So he is my favorite who I talk about in passing on the podcast a lot, but have rarely covered because there's not a ton in terms of like full stories about him. But he's my favorite because I got into classics as an actual like field of study, because 14 years ago I started writing a novel about Cadmus Harmonia and Harmonia on a whim.
Really?
And so they're like my complete origin point for everything I have today. I've still not finished the novel. It's now become something completely different that still features them. So he's such a fascinating figure for me, and I love to hear that he ended up kind of like being utilized again in Phoenicia in that way.
Yeah, there is an increase, especially in the Hellenistic period, because again, interconnected is a very loaded term. Mm. But it is. The Mediterranean became increasingly interconnected after the during the Hellenistic period, because you have so many people moving to and fro. You have, yes, elites visiting. You have wandering poets going from town to town that you see in honorary inscriptions. And you also get a bunch of local cults that seek recognition. One of my favorites has to do with Artemis, and this is on Magnesia on the Meander. So this is in Asia Minor still. Asia Minor, there's a lot of evidence for it just because there's a lot of temples in Asia Minor. Also, they really like to write things down. There's an epigraphic habit, the land of the chattering stones. But you have, for example, that Artemis appears in the 3rd century. There's an epiphany of that Artemis. She appears, and then the people there go to different polities to seek recognition for that epiphany of Artemis in their area, because they want to create a festival, a Pan-Hellenic festival, and they want people from other cities to come and recognize. There's an increase in that. You start seeing a bunch of festivals for these like local cults that want bigger like recognition. They want to attract more people from all around. And they even, we have an inscription, they sent a letter to the Seleucid king asking for recognition, asking for a delegation there. And you have these sacred embassies, the Theoroi, who are like, they're sacred embassies. They go to the courts of Hellenistic kings and they go, hey, do you want to like give some money or like attend our festival? And usually they'll give something because that's one of the main ways that Hellenistic kings can influence a region is by the system of patronages. So temples and the favoring of temples, the recognition of temples becomes another way that you see the collation of local traditions or local myths, especially they sometimes get greater recognition. Conversely, for example, you have temples in Central Asia under territories in the Seleucids that probably had a cult statue to Zeus in the middle. But there's increasing evidence that there's also local indigenous worship alongside the statue of Zeus. Their temples have little niches, indents in them, where you have like water vessels that were probably used for local religious rites, coinciding along a temple that had this like cultic statue to Zeus, and Zeus was a big figure in like the imperial quote-unquote pantheon of the Seleucids. So you do certainly see like an emphasis on the local variations. There's another epiphany later on in the 40s that Zeus actually comes to the battlefield and like stops an army from rampaging. It's so weird. He like envelops a mist. He like makes the enemies think that dogs are barking off in the distance, and just confuses the heck out of the Parthians that are invading that region.
That's very cool.
Yeah, but like there's, for people that are super into myth, there's so much that continues on, not evolves, that changes and adapts to like the political situations going on in the Hellenistic period, where you have people and empires just vying for control over regions. So like they'll grant things to temples. Temples will have a greater role to play. The gods, like, and like, heck, you even have mythos around like rulers. The Seleucid mythos, the Seleucus the First mythos is especially like pertinent and stuff like that. So myth is used in so many ways. It's not only the Greeks coming in and like, oh, you have Artemis over here or something like that. No, you also have like local indigenous people that still have their own deities that they worship, worshiping alongside, participating in festivals alongside the Hellenistic or the Greek populations that are in these areas. Yeah, you don't have to be a Greek to enjoy a festival.
It's so interesting that I think it's such a fascinating comparison to obviously like the more modern examples of empire and things, and the way that like it became about wiping out the old culture versus like having a new one live alongside it. Like, I just think of, you know, imperialism in North America. And
yeah,
like, I mean, as somebody from Canada, it's a huge part of our lives, especially right now, because my country is continuing to find horrible mass graves of children at residential schools that were just a complete government and widespread attempt to actually wipe out a culture, like systematically wipe out a culture. Yes. And it's so interesting and obviously refreshing to hear of like, yeah, I mean, obviously these empires weren't great and there's always problems attached to it. But at the same time, they weren't going there trying to wipe out the existing culture and implement Greek instead. It was like, no, we're going to bring our Greek stuff and we're going to all kind of coexist. You know, that's probably it's a nicer sounding term than probably what it was. But ultimately, it's like there's a little bit of everything in an interesting way.
Yeah, at the end of the day, the state still held the monopoly on violence.
Yeah,
like they still had the army, but that's just not the way ancient states worked, because they're limited in their application. Like, their ability to press down on you is so much more limited than like modern empires, modern nation states, where they can just seep into every single thing you do. Like, ancient states, they didn't have the technology, they didn't have the resources to really get into, they didn't have the mentality, really.
That was going to be my question, because I think also a huge part of, well, I mean, not I think, but definitely a huge part of, certainly in North America, is it's just Christianity, right? It's like the viewpoint that Christianity is the one, and thus we must wipe out indigenous, whereas I don't think that ancient religious structures had that same mentality of like, yours is wrong and ours is right.
Yeah. It's like newer scholarship has emphasized. So the Seleucids are famed, not for much, but they're certainly famed for their part in the revolt of the Jewish peoples. The famous Hanukkah story, the famous like quashing of the Jewish peoples during the reign of Antiochus IV.
Interesting. And how little I know about modern religions. I'm like, I have thoughts.
I have opinions, especially on the reception of the Seleucid state in the Rugrats Hanukkah special. they did my boy Antiochus dirty.
That's some niche millennial content that I'm here for.
But like, now it's becoming clear, because our sources are all Jewish. They, of course, do not like the Seleucids. They're writing after everything happens, and they want to provide a nice, tidy narrative that gives a nationalist, like, oh, this is who we are, and it was us against them. When in the reality, it was much more blurry. It wasn't that the Seleucids, because this is not their policy, this is not what they do. They don't go into a region and go, you cannot worship these gods, you must worship the Hellenic gods. That is not how that works. That is how that works in like Rome Total War. When you're playing as the Seleucids, you want to have Greek culture everywhere, and people gamify ancient empires like this, even not in games, but they think it's a zero-sum game of religion and culture and myth, when it's not. Everything can get into a wonderful quagmire. And for example, the Jewish revolt, there were factions inside of Judea that were vying for control, and one of them sought to get the support of the Seleucid king. And what's the best way to do that? Show that you're like a Greek, like have a little bath, have a little Hellenic temple to Zeus, because that's just the easiest way. That's the path of least resistance to occupying an area, or to like governing an area. If you have an elite class that is quote unquote Hellenized, that follows Greek customs, it's just easier to do business with them, because they're from a same like cultural, or at least they're in concert with similar like language and value sets that you are. So Antiochus just went, oh, why shouldn't I support these guys that it's going to be easier to govern in a region that's like in the border, because they just recently acquired that from the Ptolemies. Yeah, exactly. So like, why not have a they're still like, he's still the high priest. They're still like Jewish religion. It's just that they want to adopt Hellenic customs. And the Seleucid king going, okay, why not? So he champions them. But then in later historiography and later writing, that conflict gets simplified because you want a tidy narrative of us versus them, especially when the kingdom of Judea becomes like a thing. And yeah, like all the Hellenistic kingdoms, empires, whatever you want to call them, suffer from this, that Greco-Roman authors and Jewish authors for the Seleucids just like disdain them to no end because the winners write the history, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's one of the things that contributes to this. But this oversimplification also, this period is so rich for those that are interested in myth, so rich to study. Because you see myth interacting in so many different aspects, especially in the material culture. Like, you have to love material culture to be in this period. There's not a lot of literature that survives.
I think that's what I struggle with, because as a storyteller, it becomes more difficult versus, like this style of looking at it from a more, like, a broader, like, historical context of the mythos and everything. But a good example and well-timed came up at the time of this recording, because I don't know when I'll release it, but at the time of this recording, my last episode was on Memnon in the story of the Trojan War, and then also just generally the way the Greek mythology understood Africa. And somebody commented on a post I had about it, mentioning a source they'd found where Memnon is said to have teamed up with Indian troops and traveled to Troy. And that was really interesting because, you know, I immediately see that and think, like, okay, well, that's coming from Hellenistic or later, because just generally they knew what India was. So, you know, they've got that reference point. But it's so interesting to see the way that it can come and meld into earlier stories once they have all these reference points of these regions beyond. And it's like, okay, well, you know, we're now very familiar with India and the Indian people. And so let's combine it with this existing story. Let's put India into the Trojan War. Like, so fascinating to see that the way these things are sort of reinterpreted to account for new knowledge, I guess.
Yeah, like the Dionysus's famed expedition to the east gets recontextualized once Alexander gets there.
Yeah.
And after there's a recent book on like Seleucid literary production, because when you think of the Hellenistic period, you see this in memes all the time. It's always the Library of Alexandria. And the Library of Alexandria was a huge center. I'm not downplaying the role of the Library of Alexandria. Pero there's other libraries. The Library of Pergamon, the Library of Antioch. Actually, there's a little snippet. I forget where it is, but Antiochus I actually invites a poet called Aratos to go to the Library of Antioch, to go to Antioch and write a commentary for the Iliad. So it's all this stuff. Like, there's so much in terms of like the literary transmission of the Iliad, commentaries on the Iliad, how the Iliad is received in the Hellenistic period that gets simplified to the Alexandria discourse. To the deficit of like other people interacting with this, like social imaginaries, how it forms notions of like space. And Antiochus III went to Ilion and did a little thing to Athena, some throwback to the Iliad. But all you hear about is Alexander doing that. But yeah, it's just like, yeah, I really like this period.
Yeah, no, but it is so fascinating also just the way that certain people and things and time periods really end up standing out, and you got to kind of, I mean, wonder why and whether it was like entirely in the ancient world or also modern construction. But yeah, I mean, the way that Alexander stands out above everyone, and like, I know it's because he, you know, went to all these places, but he didn't live very long or do very much.
With a small loan of an incredibly well-polished army from his papa.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, like, yeah. He was a rich boy who had, like, just went and, I mean, you could connect him with so many modern notions of people, you know. He was a very rich boy who inherited a lot from his father, including the kingdom itself, and then just went and like used his money to just expand with no understanding of what he would do once he had expanded. And then everything blew up because of that. When you die young and you haven't prepared for what's going to happen after you die, well, everyone's kind of fucked.
some like Alexander scholars somewhere off in the distance just like crane their head and go, someone's talking smack because he's a darling. Can't talk.
Also, I'm talking all of this with very little concrete knowledge and truly all just like the way that my brain is able to like take in tiny things over time and then talk like I know what I'm talking about. But I mean, it's like the way he is the biggest, and then Cleopatra, like you were saying earlier, and the Library of Alexandria, the way these are the things that everyone talks about when so much else existed that like objectively could be seen as the same level of importance overall or what have you. It's just fascinating. And the way that these certain people like capture the imagination or time periods, like the way that classical Greece has completely is like sort of the be all and end all of Greece when you're not, you know, necessarily a scholar, but certainly I'm sure among scholars too.
Right.
Ugh, nerds. Thank you, as always, for listening. This conversation was so much fun. We talked for over 2 hours, and even then I could have listened to even more about all of this. Like, I literally, unfortunately, had to go. It was all just so fascinating, and there's so much to take in about the whole time period and the region, and just, God, there's so much there. During this period, the Greeks traveled so far and they took over so many places, so far east and south. So there's just so much more insight into all these ancient regions because of this. And I was so fascinated to hear about how much they kind of like melded their Greek traditions and practices and gods with the same pieces from those other regions. It's super cool. I'm so used to thinking of primarily Hellenistic Egypt and the Ptolemies, or just Alexander generally, that when I consider the Hellenistic period. So hearing about all of these kings and regions that are far beyond Greece and Egypt and Rome is so eye-opening. I could talk about it all forever, just emphasizing how interesting all of this is and how much I just consistently want to know more about all of it. But hey, luckily there's another episode of this Hellenistic wonder. So stay tuned. Next Friday, we hear more about the Hellenistic period and all their myths and kings and so much more. Make sure you follow Eduardo on Twitter, not least because he's incredibly funny on Twitter and shares lots of otter photos. There's a link in the episode's description, as always. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians and handles so many podcast-related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and videos to editing and research and so much more. And we have an intern this month. How cool is that? Grace Roby is helping out with loads of things. When I'm recording this, she hasn't actually started yet, so I can't be specific, but I just know she's going to be great. The podcast is hosted and monetized by Acast. I fucking love learning this stuff, and I truly will never get over how much you all love it too. How you, as listeners, help me keep this up, keep speaking to scholars and learning new and fascinating things, helping scholars share their work beyond the confines of academia, all of it. Thank you all so much for listening and continuing to listen. It's been fucking life-changing. I am Liv, and I absolutely love this shit so fucking much.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.